I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
You got this guy.
This is exciting. I don't think any gig that can't be fun at 12 o'clock can be fun. 12 o'clock's the perfect time for a gig. I like to acknowledge the fact that we're having this chat today on the traditional land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. George Miller. I'm mostly worried that I had to put my hair up to stop the mic making noise, so I'm in a very insecure position, and I'm talking to Australia's greatest film director, so I'm a bit nervous. Not really.
Arguably.
Don't worry, I'm going to come at you real hard.
All right, good.
Today's the day you get brought down. That's
right,
2021.
I
know George a little bit, and we've chatted a little bit before, and it's been very exciting getting to know George. And so what I really want to do today is make sure the chat isn't a series of questions, but just a talk. And George, you wanted to sort of ask the audience what they want to hear about.
Well, just so it might be a bit more useful, if I understood a few things about what you're interested in, and if you, by show of hands, who's interested in story? Okay, a lot of people, thank you. Who's interested in specifically screen stories? Okay, quite a few. And who's interested in the adaptation of other media into screen stories? Oh, a lot of hands, that's great. And who's either written a screenplay or thinking of writing a screenplay?
Don't do
it. Oh, good. A lot of people. That's good.
Who's interested in basketball? Okay, great. Okay. Well, let's start with basketball.
And just a couple of who's interested in adaptations of stories into musicals?
Jesus Christ.
Oh, okay.
Don't
this is great.
You dare.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's another.
Who's interested in performance? Okay, so we're good.
Yeah. Well, let's start as broad as you can, and I know this sounds like a very Sydney Writers Festival question, but it's my obsession, and I think yours as well, which is to talk. We use this word story like a capital S word, not just a bedtime story. So why don't you tell me what you mean when you say story, and perhaps what's its role? What's its role in culture? There you go.
Well, story, I think. For me, it's important when I start out on anything to understand what I mean by story. And it's not obviously the plot, and it's not a series of events. I think the quality of story that I think is key is that it is received by some audience. Now, that could be an audience of one. It could even be yourself. I've often thought, what happens when you make yourself laugh with a thought? Or make yourself scared with a thought. Somehow you've gone through a process of a little narrative in your head. So the audience can be yourself, but usually it's one other person or many other people or whole cultures or whole nations or whole religions or whole of mythologies that are recurring throughout time. So story, in a sense, requires someone to receive the story. That's what I mean by story. It's the experience received by others.
I'm really interested in the sort of verbification of story, like the narrativization. I used the word narrativization at dinner the other night, and someone just mocked me for hours and said that's not a word. And I said, in my world, it is. It's like that's a standard wanky discourse, but actually, there's no. And the verb of story, storification, is also a word in our world, even though it sounds like the verbification of a noun. But like storifying, I'm interested in, when you said you can make yourself laugh with a thought or scared with a thought, I suppose this is redundant, we all know this, but we make sense of our lives by, I think, constantly storifying what happens to us. to centralize ourselves as either the hero or the victim of everything that happens. We're sort of solipsist, making ourselves the hero. And I guess story plays a similar role in culture. It's like trying to make sense of the chaos a bit. Is that...
Look, absolutely. In fact, the only way we as human beings make any sense of the world is through narrative. You can take a lot of data, and even the great scientific narratives require a very strong sense of story. I've just got to say, I'm here to doing this for two reasons. I've just finished shooting, and we are in the process of editing a film, which is about a narratologist, someone who tells stories about stories. So I'm kind of primed for a conversation like this, and I've got a lot to unload.
That's what I want. I want that conversation. Yeah, I think these guys do.
And the other thing I want to say, I'm here because of Chrissy Sharp, the wonderful Chrissy Sharp, who asked me to be here, and I couldn't say no to her, exactly. And you're the same.
Exactly the same. Yeah.
So, look, story, I believe, is particularly earlier on, we know, throughout all cultures and all time, story is the way we make meaning of what's an entirely bewildering world. If we didn't have... We survive by stories. And we happen to be in this country, in this land, a part, or at least we... recognized that the culture of the First Nations survived precisely by the power of the stories they told. It's the oldest culture that exists, and they mapped out, they GPSed the land through story. They understood how you survive in this very barren land compared to others, how you could traverse it. That land, and I think that, and this happened across all time, we just happen to have a culture which has preserved the vestiges of that, and right through all cultures, in the absence of what we call scientific or public knowledge or empirical knowledge, people were able to create stories which, if they didn't have them, would not explain how the world works. Wouldn't have explained the mysteries and the wonders and the catastrophes of those worlds. There would be no way to comprehend them. And I think that's continues today. So you've got the broadest possible sense of story and the most intimate sense of story. And it's the only way we can make sense of the world, I believe.
I think that's right. And when people like, you know, long-haired arty types talk about story as sort of the only way you really make sense of the world, I think it can sound like a sort of wank fest or a slightly self-aggrandizing, like, well, we tell stories and stories are very important. And people like, no, like, economic wealth distribution is important, you're just a wanker. But I think... And I have been a bit like that. I'm a bit pragmatic. I'm not one of these people that are like, you know, art's the most important thing in the world. I'm like, I do a bit of art and that's good. But I actually have grown into an appreciation of what you're talking about. And I'm always incredibly wary about speaking about First Nations culture. But it is so interesting. You're talking about the fundamentalness of story that in my perhaps ridiculously naive or romanticized understanding, Indigenous culture in Australia, story, song, science, country, and self, just to list the right amount of things for the number of fingers I have, are inexorably connected in a way that I have had to really try and understand, but in a way that speaks to how fundamental story is, because it is so ancient. And when an Indigenous person says, "I sing for this country," they are, I think, saying, by Sing, they mean sort of tell the story of, and for this country, they kind of mean look after, but also tell the story of its history and represent it. And it's really connected. And I just find that hugely fascinating. And I'm just one of those people saying something in my head rather than framing a question. But I do think something, and I don't particularly want to get stuck on the specifics of film because I think the bigger conversation is really interesting, but I was looking through your films and noticing how much mythology, not just telling the story of what's going on, but the transcendent story in the Mad Max films, obviously. I was even remembering that the Robin Williams penguin in Happy Feet, you know, he's got this thing around his neck and it's got a whole mythology around it, that it's a religious thing, it's a totem, or, you know, and that desire that has always been in us to not just narrativize our lives in a way to make sense, but narrativize them to get them off the earth, to make them bigger than just our, and you said it a minute ago, it explains the fires and the floods and the disease and the death and stuff. What's the question in there? Is it very human to want your stories to be bigger than you in order to make sense of it?
I think, essentially, yes. I think it is so elemental to us. It's so fundamental that, put it this way, if we didn't tell each other stories, if we weren't capable of tell each other stories, I don't think we could survive. If you didn't have those stories, we couldn't survive even in terms of our psyche, but it, just as importantly, in a physical sense. If you don't know that a certain pool of water could be toxic, and if there's no narrative about that that you could tell to a child, every child, every human has to discover it for the first time themselves. And I think it's even pre-human. I think a lot of information, a lot of narrative, if you like, is carried in our instinct.
Epigenetically, sort of thing.
Yes,
like,
yes. But think about the absence of story. That is some experience told to another or expressed to another, which allows that person to have a sense of what the world is, so that they can navigate the world, there would be no survival. Don't eat that berry. Don't drink that particular drink.
Well, and further, this is a sin, or this is, you'll be punished for this, a moral framework as well as a logistical framework. And obviously we know, because we've lived a lot of human history, that some of them can be really useful for a long, long time, and some of them can be really fucking awful.
Yes.
Once they're sort of and held by power.
And despite the notion that all this could be a wank, there are great narratives of science. I think that they're the most powerful narratives. And one thing I've noticed about science is that that most of us can only be tourists in the land of science. The mathematics. For me, the greatest act of human creativity, collective human creativity, is the 20th century physics, basically taught. People often refer to it as the Einsteinian physics. And we are here today, and people are listening to what we're saying today in other places because of Einstein, of Maxwell, and Newton, and so on. To understand why that's a reality, that's true and provable and tangible, it's impossible for us to really know how that's happening, because the language of that is mathematics and concepts that are expressed through mathematics. So we have to have metaphor to explain it.
Yeah.
We have to have metaphor. And once we get into that, then they become very powerful stories. I mean, just one of the most striking things for me was when Einstein asked himself at a very young age, what would the universe look like if I rode on a beam of light? That's a very poetic notion. And that led to that remarkable bit of information that whether we like it or not, we still exist by it and we still function by it, that time and space is a continuum, that the four forces of the universe may be somehow...
It's a unified...
A unified. That's an amazing narrative. So it's not just some sort of... It's not just some indulgence of we who think storytelling is important. I think it's a necessity. Just to try to finish that off. And it's a continuum. If you go back to cultures before the recording of history and you come to us today, the continuum is trying to explain this universe that we're in. If you look at the stories of any indigenous people, the way they explain the stars makes a lot of sense. What's replaced that is the knowledge that we've got from the Hubble telescope and Newtonian physics and Einsteinian physics. All of that is part of the same continuum. Along that continuum are the mythologies, and along that continuum are the religions in whatever form they come. But it's all part of the process. And part of that great mosaic are the stories that you might tell or I might tell or your favourite storytellers or authors might tell. It's all part of the same continuum. That's the understanding, at least, that I feel I'm coming to. I'll shut up in a minute, but the thinker who's got me this far, of course, is Joseph Campbell, who is not just a philosopher. It's not coming only out of his head. But Campbell did us all the service of spending 40 years alone in a library, studying not only comparative religion, but all the narratives of humankind and kind of collating what is common to all of them, and came up with the notion of the monomyth, the same stories repeated over and over again across time and in all cultures. And he said, just to finish up, he said something that's very, very powerful. What's your definition of mythology? And he said, other people's religion.
Yeah.
And he made the point that basically we understand the world through analogy and metaphor. We understand the mysteries through analogy and metaphor. And in the absence of other information, we have to create gods and monsters and events which make sense to us from a human perspective. Sorry, that's a bit...
No, I mean, there's seven paths I want to go down out of that. And one is obviously... I think when we met, the reason we got talking and didn't stop for 2.5 hours when we were doing someone else's podcast, the poor bastards had to edit it, but is that we're basically science nerds who make myth or tell stories. And I don't think that's all artists, but it is interesting that for someone like you, and I think I would probably be philosophically reasonably aligned in terms of being a materialist or whatever, or, you know, that you are so interested in myth. I don't suppose that is weird at all, because the whole point is, once you have an Einsteinian understanding or an atomic sort of understanding of the universe, then you go, right, aren't humans weird the way we tell stories? And you get intrigued by it. I'm obsessed by it. And it's amazing, right? It's 28 minutes, shit. So, okay, to try and go back, just to try and talk a little bit about film as a medium, you know, perhaps the question is, in what way is film unique as a way to tell stories, and do you feel like it's a particularly awesome way to tell stories, or are you just suited to it? You know, would you... Yes, could you speak to film as a tool?
You're asking what is a story that's best told by film rather than some other medium?
Yes, I suppose. Yeah, why film?
Well,
why film, dude?
Why film? Look, I can tell you by telling stories. There's no question that any particular story has an optimum medium. Some things are told better on film. It's a question it's a question you got to ask yourself all the time. if you don't ask yourself the question, you could be working in the wrong area. I just really give you an example, might seem tangential. I remember we took our kids to see Billy Elliot, the musical.
Second best family musical of the last 20 years.
Yes, yeah. Second best. Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah. And probably get some insights from you on this. What was really interesting is that was, as you know, based on a film. And the same writer and the same director of the film then worked in another medium, which is on the stage in a musical, and introduced music. And my kids are very interested. They loved it. They want to see it again. This is when they were quite young. And I said, well, you know, they made a movie of it, and let's watch the movie. It was a great movie, but they were not nearly as impressed by the movie as the musical. And then I realized it's because they are two completely different processes, or not processes, but end up with a completely different result. And there are two really stark examples in it. At one point in the movie, you see Billy Elliot at the fridge, and he opens the fridge, he closes the fridge, and there's his long dead mother, or the mother that he lost. And he has under his bed letters from his mother that was shown as basic events or incidences in the movie. What happened in the musical is we get to see in the abstraction of the musical the mother appear out of the shadows and the two sing a duet, which was really wonderful. At the end of the movie, there's a similar scene, which by the way, is much more powerful than just knowing that information. At the end of the movie, as you know, Billy Elliot goes to audition with the Royal Ballet, and he's very, very shy and awkward, and it feels like he's failed, and everybody has got together to try to get him there, and it feels like he's failed. And in the movie, someone in the interviewing panel says, and Billy, as he's leaving, what is it about dancing? How do you feel when you dance? And he says, it's like electricity. In the play, it's a song, and a most wonderful song, and he can give full expression to the experience. So believe it or not, and it's proved, because it wasn't just the different talents, same people, same writers, and Elton John songs. And that's the difference. That they discovered was better told, ultimately, I believe, better told. It found his best expression in a musical on a stage live. And I think you could look at that right through stories. For me, you can't do great, epic, sweeping novels in a movie, in a cinema movie. You could do them, definitely, in long form, but you can't condense them. In fact, short stories are often the best form. And it's not me saying it. I was one of those people who had a kind of a phone acquaintance with Stanley Kubrick. And his favourite movie example was Clockwork Orange, a short story by Anthony Burgess. He said it was perfect because it was manageable within the time that you have to tell a movie. And he told me that he had lots and lots of people reading stories for them. If you heard about a story that might be interesting or an author that might be interesting, he'd have people read them. And I said, well, how did you find the people? He said, I put an ad in the paper asking for people to read for him. And he said, I ended up, and those that I knew were acute in their observations, I kept on hiring them to do it. And he said, I had one schoolgirl, I had a barrister, I had a housewife. He said, I had about a dozen people right through, I think it was UK, I don't know if there were any from America. Now, the thing was, none of those people knew that they were basically doing this work for Stanley Kubrick. He was completely anonymous. But it was his way of, instead of reading them himself or having his agents read and so on, it was his way of doing his work. And his last film was based on a short story. I can't even remember what it was.
Eyes Wide Shut,
but I don't know what the original short story was, but simply found in this way. So that one thing, that That is an ideal view form. There's got to be, it can't be too talky, obviously, but it can't be silent. It can be silent, but it, look, there's no ideal. Must know this. Do you think you've done some adaptations? I mean, what observations have you got?
Well, I think I think you're right. Epic worlds can be turned into great films, but I very rarely feel like Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter or any of those things that are entire worlds are improved by the genre. They certainly had a good old crack, but you know, you've got to get back to the book. I think it's really a matter of sometimes not very good novels are better for adaptation, or at least that, like for example, Matilda's not very good novel. It's a great, but it's a children's story, and it's structurally very Dali, and it's really made to be read chapter at a time at night to your kids. It doesn't have a beautiful literary arc, which allowed Dennis Kelly, the guy who adapted it for stage before I came along and ruined it with songs, to sort of find where the big beats were and draw a different arc. So it's easier to adapt something that's not perfect narratively, because, I mean, Lord of the Rings is weird, but if whatever you take out is a genuine loss because it's a world, you know, it's some weird thing with talking trees or whatever. If it's gone, you've sort of lost some of the magic. I think I'm interested in your latest film. I'm so interested in it because I've sort of... It's because everyone seems to be being quite opaque about it, and I know Tilda and Idris Elba have been, and I saw those guys after the shoot, and everyone's just like, it's the best shoot ever. So I'm so excited by it. I'm very interested in the fact that it's a novella, that the source text was a novella. So just to sort of illuminate what George was talking about, that he's in the right space to talk about the role of storytelling. He's just, George is a storyteller who's just told a story on film, or is in the process of telling a story on film about a woman who tells stories about storytelling, who goes to a storytelling conference and then gets caught in a sort of mythological story that is built on a story that comes from like Thousand and One Nights, one of the most ancient suites of stories that we know. So you're right up your own story.
Yes, yeah.
But I'm so excited by it because it's also, I heard about it and went, oh, that'll be, he's obviously making a little art house two-hander with two great actors. And then I'm like, the budget's $60 million. What's he doing down there in Tasmania? You know. So I mean, what can you tell us about that? And is this a bit of a kind of, is this you heading towards a kind of perfect storm of your interest in mythology and stuff?
And first of all, I'd never thought of the story in the way you describe it.
I just ruined it.
It's a much more interesting way to describe it. And it's true. It is, again, I've never really thought about it, but it is a perfect storm of my interest. And that's why I think I've told that story. It's been around in my head, having... read it.
Sorry, it's a novella by A.S. Byatt called The Gin in the Nightingale's Eye. Right?
Yeah, I don't know if anybody knows that she wrote a number of short stories, basically fairy tales, grown-up fairy tales. And this was one of them that she put in this anthology. And I read it and I thought there's something about the story and it wouldn't let go. And I've made other films and there were all sorts of different things. But there's a kind of a Darwinian thing that happens in the back of your
20
head.
Years later, you're still thinking, that'd be a good film. And given I've been thinking that for 20 years, it's probably a keeper.
Yeah, yeah. It's a survival of the fittest. And I think you really... Look, I do get asked, what stories do you choose to tell? Why do you choose to tell them? And I've never been able to bring them to the front of my head, the notions. But the best I can do is this. First of all, stories are apprehended by the whole human, the whole of us as humans, meaning we read them and feel them viscerally, emotionally, intellectually, anthropologically, mythologically, spiritually, across great sweeps of time, or just in the moment. It's the whole of the human being that experiences the story. And they resonate with us, and if they have any meaning, they stick around. That's one thing. The other thing I realized, that you're looking for stories that have any meaning. Really, there's an essential quality in that there's more to them than meets the eye. You could read something just on the surface, but there's a lot of iceberg under the tip. It's a very easy thing to say. It's a very, very difficult thing to kind of get into your work. But it's really the subtext, really all the undercurrents in the story that ultimately have resonance. And there's lots and lots of examples of that. If I could just take I realized this when I was very, very young. But back in the 50s, my parents, I grew up in rural Australia. My parents bought my twin brother and I one of those vinyl discs of stories. On one side, there was the small one about the little donkey who was sold to Joseph and Mary when Jesus was a baby, and the little donkey that turned up in Bethlehem.
It's Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. What? Same story, the underdog.
It's the
underdog carrier. Yeah. Great tale, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lovely story. Yeah. And it was Bing Crosby, if anyone remembers who he is, who narrated it. On the flip side, there was The Happy Prince. And again, these were spoken stories performed. Orson Welles performed. Bernard Herrmann wrote the music. And it was a beautifully executed piece that he had done on radio in the 40s.
The BBC, yeah, I remember.
And remember, this was a time of no TV, no internet. There was radio, and there was a Saturday matinee.
And Twitter.
And no Twitter.
Just radio and Twitter. Yeah.
We listened to The Small One twice. We listened to The Happy Prince, Oscar Wilde, at least 100 times. And I often wondered what the difference was. The Small One's a lovely story, but it doesn't have a lot of iceberg under the tip. Yeah, it's about humility, it's about grace, and so on.
You on first listen, you get everything that it's got
for you. Yeah, yeah.
And I think you have this anxiety, because as you, and I'm not putting myself in the same place as you, but I have an experience of the older I get and the more stories I've been involved in telling, and I'm very lucky because I've been in different genres, I get more and more obsessed by the allegorical weight it can carry. And that's actually what I look for, is can this story carry a bunch load of other shit I want to talk about? So the narrative's there, but can it carry a really strong ethical question or a moral lesson or some subtextual thing that speaks to the human condition? What is it to have meaning in a meaningless universe, or whatever my obsessions are, which I think you share. And as you get on and you're more and more looking for that, I mean, for me, the experience was Groundhog Day, the musical, which we loaded up with so much subtext, and you could watch it 10 times and be going, and of course it didn't go as well. I have this anxiety that as you go on in your career, a challenge that I think is real, and that I think throughout your career you've been remarkable at, is that you've gone on that journey, even within the Mad Max thing, of going, wow, I want to, the allegorical story is the point, you know. And you have managed to never lose. I described Groundhog Day as slightly wanking ourselves into a corner, you know, like, and I think that's the challenge. I disagree. It's fucking great, but it's just, the challenge is to understand that your audience sometimes just wants to watch it once and only wants to get the small one out of it. They just want to go, a donkey carried Jesus. And other stories people want to listen to 100 times and keep learning more. And you've got to try and do both.
It's a trick. Yeah. It's a trick. If you venture into it, you know, it's fraught. I mean, you can make a story, you can put that all in there, and you feel, okay, I think we've really orchestrated it well, and whatever, and the audience is, it just is overwhelmed, it's bewildering, and so on. You can make that mistake, but at least you ventured there.
Yeah.
Well, all I know is that stories that need that, let's call it, this is another wanky word, but need that nourishment, or that sense that there's something in the story.
There's nutrition
that has meaning,
as well as just taste.
There's no question that that has to be there. I guess otherwise the story has no meaning. Otherwise it's just something that's on the surface that you go by, and it goes by and you forget it, you know.
I don't mind them. I'm happy to watch, you know, Dwayne The Rock Johnson in Rampage. It doesn't bother me at all, but I won't go back and I don't think about it after I've left the cinema, although it was a big white monkey. I love talking to you so much, George, and I would like also to other people to have a chance to answer questions. So we're going to take a couple of questions from the audience. Beautiful, self-selecting. Person stage right.
Sequels. That's the question, sequels.
Oh, sequels?
Sequels. Mm. The temptation or the demand for the sequel, and then the burden of the story for a sequel of something that's so beloved, what happens?
Really good question, question. Put it this way. If someone asks me to do a sequel of, say, Happy Feet, well, I did do a sequel of Happy Feet, I wouldn't be able to come up with a third one because the world was pretty much explored there.
Happy Feet beyond Thunderdome. I just reckon you should do it. Happiest Feet. Hands.
The interesting thing, maybe we could do it.
Hell, we go back.
But the interesting thing with the Mad Maxes, is that after every film, I never wanted to make another Mad Max film. But having been in that world, having known, getting to know them, and getting to understand that things change with time, and indeed cinema changes with time, and audiences and the way they read films change with time. The temptation comes up and the little seed happens in the back of your head. But, you know, you just don't want to go back there. You've explored them, you think you have. But working in an allegorical world is very tempting, even though these films are set in some dystopian future, and you basically regress to some kind of neo-medieval structures. They really are about who we are today. They always are, to the extent that we share in common behaviours that have been basically pretty consistent throughout all of time. Dominance, hierarchies, all those things that are involved in the Mad Max films. So they once lured in there, it's very hard not to let your imagination go. And pretty soon the stories pop up again, competing with all the other stories in your head or that you've been working on. And you say, hey, this could be a really interesting film to make. It's never because, hey, let's make a sequel, or the studio or somebody saying, hey, it'd be great if we could get a sequel. It's always about having something that you have to tell, always.
And it's that nourishment thing again. Is this world still strong enough to carry more, to tell a story with allegorical weight? And I suppose the reason Mad Max doesn't easily die is because it is its own mythology. So actually, whatever you want to tell can be told in that world
because it's
because of its allegorical massive foundation.
That is true, and we're doing another Fury Road, which is the last Mad Max done, you know, quite some time ago now. I never saw it. It was just using that world. And again, it's a really good test of the worth of a story. If you keep pushing it away, it keeps coming back at you. It gives you a sense that there's something there. The one we're about to do was written before we shot Fury Road as part of the backstory for the main character Furiosa. And we wanted Nico Lathouris and I, we basically wrote this story to help the actors and to help the crew to give some sort of weight to the world. It wasn't, because if you just tell it on the surface, you're not going to get that deep stuff that we, if it's not cohesive, then the story won't make sense. A lot of spectacle, ultimately, without much else to go with it. I must say, it was one of the reasons that made me pleased with you. That pleased me most about Fury Road is that most of that stuff was read. And so this sequel that we're doing has existed for a long time, and it's a story that won't let go. In fact, some people said, why don't you make this and not do Fury Road, because it seems to be a better story. So it's a film I want to get out of my system as much as I
can tell you today, I mean, I'm quite excited. I'm in it. He's putting me in it.
You'll have to now. No. He just sprung that on me.
I just don't know why you wouldn't put me in it. I'm weird looking. I can get angry.
Can you write a song for it?
I'll write a song for it. Write it now. I've written the whole Furiosa musical. Sorry,
it's a long question, probably with a short answer. The original Mad Max movie was made for a few $100,000. It had a huge return on investment, and I don't mean that financially. I mean cinematically, influentially, nationally, putting Australia on that, all that other stuff. At the time, did you feel that was going to happen and sequels and all this? When you were making it back when, was that did you have a feeling that this was going to be kind of amazing in the way that it was, or were you kind of giving it a go and kind of seeing what's going to happen, if you like?
Two-word answer, emphatically no. I honestly had no, you know, it was just, I'm not going to say it's luck, because that sounds too random. I know that when I worked on that film, I put everything we knew into that film, which wasn't a lot, but everything we knew about filmmaking, I didn't know much about storytelling. I came to film mainly interested in the visual expression. I was one of those kids that drew. My best friends were always the kids that were the best drawers in the class and so on. I was very interested in art, and I was very interested in cinema, particularly silent cinema. And I thought this was a story to tell. And I ended up making that film. I finished at the end of that film in a great state of bewilderment as to how to make movies. But there was something intrinsic to the story that had seemed to have a lot of resonance. And trying to avoid a long answer, I couldn't understand why this story, which I thought was about Australia, obviously referring a lot, was set in Australia and the culture I knew, this car culture that I knew of, that some people, and I knew it had reference to the American Western, and it was a pared down world. I won't go into the reasons for all of that. And then suddenly it seemed to have a strong resonance in Japan. And when I got to Japan, they said, oh, Mad Max is a samurai. Mm. And they said, you must have seen a lot of Kurosawa movies. Mm. And to my shame, I said, who's Kurosawa? I did. I subsequently discovered very much who it was. This is what it was like making films in those days. We had no cinematheques. We had no real knowledge of cinema. It was just what we saw on TV, what we saw in the in popular cinema and what we saw in the film festival.
It plays into what you were talking about. I get slightly irritated by sort of reductive statements like there are only five stories or whatever, but without a doubt our stories come from a long way back and are shared, as you say, almost epigenetically, and certainly we are soaked in these things, and so it's perfectly possible that you would write The Last Samurai by accident. And it's because it's also the small one. It's also like the one donkey who is a bit of an outcast, but now he's carrying Jesus. And Mad Max, you know, Max had lost his wife, and now he has to be the one lone man standing against the powers that be. And they just keep coming round, but they carry different, you know, subtextual burdens.
Yeah,
you know.
different clothing. But just to finish this off. The good thing that happened, the really good thing that happened to me, is that I came away from that film with a tremendous sense of failure, a great sense of I'm just not cut out to make films. Films are way too tough. And that stopped me from getting too hubristic about its success, because I was confronted deep down with the sense of failure. And then I was smart enough to say, why did it succeed in Japan? Why did it succeed in Scandinavia and all around the world? What was it? And then I realised, of course, that I didn't have a sense of it at the beginning, but Max is a pretty classic archetype. The French call it Max, a Western on wheels. And it tapped into those archetypes. So then that was an opening to go into truly understand mythology. So I got into the practice first, and then basically processed it.
It's great that you're telling the story like that, because most of us retrospectively claim that our accidents were like some kind of genius. I'd always knew all along that it was actually about this.
But no,
it's,
no.
I think it's often just, you know, it was just a unique, it's an archetypical story, but your voice and the anarchy of it and just the world building, the names and the aesthetic, and I mean, it was taking accidentally an archetype and putting it through a Millerian filter that no one had ever seen, but it was bonkers, right? And you've been being bonkers for 15 years.
I tell you, it's if bonkers is not a bad word. I remember when I wanted. Oh, we're running out of time, but I remember when I didn't tell anybody that I wanted to make films. I didn't tell my family or my friends or anything. And all the time I was at university, I was interested in film, but as I said, I was much more interested in art, because I actually thought, I am a bit bonkers, and I shouldn't let people know, you know. I want to be a respectable doctor.
Yeah.
And then I was lucky enough to be able to express it. And maybe, you know, maybe at least my level of being bonkers had some meaning to people. I was able to harness it to some degree. But it's true. They are bonkers. You need to be a bit bonkers to do what we do.
Yeah. Well, you got to let out your inner bonkers. I think that's why you walk away. That's what storytelling is. Yeah. They're both classic. But, you know, in my meditation on this over the years, is there is a huge amount of luck, but you know, if you take everything that you are into these stories and let your shitty little life be the filter through which you put these archetypes, and it will come out unique, you know. And obviously, when I say bonkers, I mean a brilliant, creative, highly intelligent, beautiful genius, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. George Miller.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.